Welcome to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society, a 501c3 nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. I'm Jeannie Horesca, Senior Advisor for Communications and Strategy at ACS. Recently, Dish Network became the first company to be fined by the Federal Communications Commission, effectively for littering in space. My guest on today's episode has called the fine, quote, a very big symbolic moment for debris mitigation. On today's episode, we're going to discuss why the fine was such a symbolic moment and both the challenges and urgency in regulating the increasing array of human-driven activities in space. So joining me from Earth for this conversation is Michelle Hanlon, Executive Director of the Center for Air and Space Law at the University of Mississippi School of Law and Professor of Practice within UM's Air and Space Law Program. She's also the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Space Law, the world's oldest law journal dedicated to the legal problems arising out of human activities in outer space, and the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Drone Law and Policy. Professor Hanlon, welcome to Broken Law.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm really excited to talk to you. This, I will admit, this is not an area that I think gets a ton of mainstream coverage, but as someone who's been exploring it in the last few days, I will say once you start paying attention to it, there's a lot going on.
And it's a lot of pretty alarming stuff. And I really appreciate the opportunity. We in the space community live in this little bubble and we just go from like amazing event to amazing event. And, you know, like you said, mainstream is not picking it up because it doesn't seem that incredible. But there is so much going on. And a lot of what's going on is really foundational for future. And so it's really important that we get more voices sort of involved in the discourse and conversation about what is going on in space and what we need to do about it.
Yeah, I want to start with a really kind of personal question, which is how you got into space law, because I do not recall a single course being offered in my law school 3 years about space law.
Absolutely. And there were none in my law school either. So as many children, I wanted to be an astronaut when I was little. My father actually is also a very passionate about space. And we were a foreign service family. My parents were U.S. diplomats and we moved every 3 years. And I can remember when his space books were unpacked. We had the whole Time Life series of all the planets. And when those books were unpacked, that was like when I felt I was at home again. And so those sort of the background of my childhood. But I failed calculus. Well, I dropped out before I could fail it. And I kind of thought, all right, so the astronaut thing's not going to work for me. So I went to law school, loved it, loved practicing law, did it for 25 years as a business lawyer. When my son was about 11 years old, he, who had picked up the space bug as well, read a book by Virgil Pop, who is a Romanian space lawyer, called Who Owns the Moon? And he said to me, Mom, you're a pretty good lawyer, right? And I said, I like to think so. And he said, you know, I really want to mine asteroids when I grow up. And according to this book, you know, we don't know who owns them. Can you figure that out by the time I grow up? And I was like, okay.
What a profound question for a kid to ask.
Oh, yeah. First of all, I'm like, what is this book? What are you reading? And this was just when Kindle came out. So as a parent, you have no idea, right? They're just sort of getting free stuff. Thankfully, it was Who Owns the Moon and not something else. So he sparked the bug in again. And when we empty nested, I told my husband, I'm going back and getting my master's of law in space law. They have programs. They have a great program at McGill. The program here at Mississippi was stumbling a bit, but I was living in Connecticut, so it was closer to be in Montreal. And the rest is history. So I'm living proof that you can change your career at 50 and do something completely different.
I find a lot of encouragement in that story. I love hearing about folks who took a dramatic turn in their career because it just makes everyone else's possibilities that much more exciting. I'm going to ask a very basic definitional question, which is when you think of space law, what is the law that we're talking about?
So space law is public international law. But what I love now that I'm teaching, you know, your first year of law school is very casebook driven, and this is the law, here's the code, USC, Federal Register. You can fit all of space law on one PowerPoint slide. Literally five treaties, only four of which have been popularly signed or signed by a lot of nations. and then a bunch of resolutions that have been passed through the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. So it is important, though, that's sort of the joke. Space law is just like these five treaties. But it is important to recognize it's not the wild, wild west. One of the things that people don't realize is international law does apply to space.
Oh, interesting.
You know, you don't like, just because you leave the bonds of Earth doesn't mean you leave everything behind. And so these people who say, oh, I want to go and I'm going to mine and I'm going to be my libertarian self. And that, you know, sure, someday that will happen. You can someday probably do that. But you're going to be tethered to Earth for a pretty long time, because as far as I can tell, there's nothing nearby where you can be growing your own food, right? Or making your own fuel. So wake up and smell the coffee, get out there and explore, but recognize that, you know, you will be taking a lot of these terrestrial laws with you. Are they going to be different? Absolutely. The law that we have is very framework oriented, and we're talking about guiding principles and things like that. But it is not sort of this, hey, I can make things up and do it all myself kind of place.
Yeah. And I, the other thing that seems to be happening right now is when I think most of those treaties, or at least the real foundational ones, came about was when governments were really the only entities doing space exploration. They were the only entities that had the resources and the motivation to do it. Increasingly, space feels like it's being commercialized. Whether it's, you know, rich people taking tourist trips to outer space, or whether it's Elon Musk's Starlink, there's so much commercial activity. Do those same frameworks that regulated, you know, US and Russian space exploration also regulate private companies' space exploration?
Absolutely. So first, space has been commercial for a long time. I mean, because telecommunication satellites were one of the very first things that we started using as a civil society. So this new, what we're seeing is more sort of services from commercial entities than ever before, and a bunch of new activities from these commercial entities than ever before. But you're absolutely right. When the space treaties were negotiated back in the late 50s and early 60s, it was essentially the United States and the Soviet Union. And they were very concerned. The Outer Space Treaty, which is what we consider our Magna Carta, was foundationally a disarmament treaty. We didn't want war in space. And it has done a great job doing that. The Soviet Union, though, did not want any private entities in space, because their system of government didn't have the concept of corporations. They didn't want private companies. And so we have a really interesting article, Article 6 in the Outer Space Treaty, because the United States said, well, you know, we're probably going to see this. We have to figure out what that means. And so the Soviet Union agreed to the concept of non-government entities in space, but only if the nation remains responsible for their acts. And so we have a very unusual provision in outer space that you don't need to have the government knew or should have known. The government is internationally responsible for the acts of its nationals, period.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely. And so that's how the laws of outer space impact commercial entities.
That's somewhat interesting. I mean, I'm thinking of the sheer magnitude of U.S. commercial activity in space right now. I can't imagine that the U.S. government has eyes and ears on all of it, and yet it's on the line for all of it.
So the U.S. government, you know, people complain all the time about our regulations, right? Well, there's a reason we have all those regulations, because the taxpayer is going to be liable if something happens. And the government has done a very good job of regulating safety, of regulating what is going on launch, right? And we see Elon Musk complain, oh, come on, you know, I need to launch. But this is sort of, and I don't want to say putting the brakes on, but just look, we have responsibilities and we have to do this sustainably. And we owe it to the taxpayer as well as to humanity that we don't mess things up a lot. And again, I don't think Elon Musk is out to mess things up. I mean, he would be the most probably hurt if orbit closes, right, due to debris. So the federal government requires a certain level of insurance, and there are a lot of safety concerns that go into launch. We're at a very interesting time right now, though, because while the FAA, which is in charge of licensing launch services, and the FCC, which is in charge of the radio frequency, you know, if you send something up there, you want to talk to it, you need to have a radio frequency for it. But now we're getting all these new space activities that are happening like you suggested, tourism. We have now companies that are going to build space stations, private space stations. We have companies that want to do in-space manufacturing. We have companies that want to go up and clean up, right? We don't have a system right now in the United States about how to regulate those companies. And that's something we have to face right away.
So let's talk about that, because talking about the international space treaties is one thing, but that's not what Dish Network was fined for. They were fined for violating an FCC regulation. So in kind of as concise a way as you can, what is the U.S. regulatory framework around space? Is it driven by the FCC? Do they have kind of jurisdiction for space activities?
So this is actually one of the things that again, we're facing a need to restructure a little bit. Right now, it's spread between three agencies. The FCC regulates that radio frequency. So as part of that, as the FCC in, you know, the general overreach that FCC does, It said, we are going to also regulate debris because it's our remit to protect the communications of our citizens. And if a satellite is up there, gets hit by debris, then that's impeding communications. And so this is how we have the authority to regulate debris. The FAA regulates launches and reentries. So anything that goes up has to get past the FAA with the license. If you plan on coming back, you have to get that license from the FAA. The Department of Commerce, through NOAA, regulates all remote sensing satellites. So any satellites that are intended to go up just to image Earth, they get licensed through NOAA.
What is NOAA?
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency. So you have these three different agencies potentially involved with any launch. And again, see what I said. I said we radio frequency, we have launch, and we have Earth imaging, but we don't have anything else. There's no Bureau of Human Spaceflight. There's no Bureau of
International Tourism.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the question. Right now, the FAA is the agency that's sort of responsible for payload review. But is that the right place for it to go? Can the FAA handle all of that? What happens when things, you know, how much are we going to regulate? What happens actually on orbit? Those are the questions that we're facing right now as a government and as a country. And this is why it's so important. And I'm so delighted to be here talking to sort of an audience that's not involved in space every day, because these questions, the solutions are going to be costly, maybe, or maybe not. But I think everybody needs to have a sense of what is going on, what might happen up there. Because even if you have no interest in going to space whatsoever, the fact is you are reliant on space right now for when you pump gas. You can't pump gas without a satellite, right? And that reliance on space is just going to grow. And so how we conduct our activities in space is going to impact every single one of us here on Earth.
And there's a physical impact. Talking about debris, which is what Dish Network's fine was about, I do want to just explain how big that problem is, because space is obviously enormous, and yet it is getting increasingly crowded. So when we think of space debris and space litter, what's the objects? What are we talking about that is littering space?
So yes, space is infinite, right? But the space around Earth, not so infinite. That is a finite resource. There's only so many orbital slots we have. Satellites can't like be right next to each other like skyscrapers in a city. They need some space, right? Space. What happens? So we view space as infinite. When something goes up into orbit, you don't really think about it. You can't see it. So humans have sent about 8,000, a little bit more than 8,000 satellites into space. Only about 4,000 of them are functional right now. So we've just sent stuff up, it lasts 20 years, and we just leave it there. In addition, we have rocket bodies. You know, you launch something, and we've seen, if you go to see the Saturn V, rockets are huge. And that a lot of that is just holding propulsion. And so when it gets into space, your rocket body is spent, and it just floats out there. And so those are the sort of the big objects that are there. And then when you have satellites that start to break down a little bit, they break up as well. And so you get smaller pieces of debris, just the wear and tear. I mean, it happens. You see cars on the side of the road that have been junked. And so we have these big, huge rocket bodies that are just drifting. And we have little pieces of satellites that are starting to break apart. on top of all that, you know, humans decided it would be really fun to break up their own satellites. And we have anti-satellite tests. And China, Russia, the United States, India have all shown the world they can break up their own satellite, which is great, but that creates a debris field as well. That satellite breaks up and you have lots of smaller pieces. Now, again, you think, well, all right, so we have these pieces of debris. The big ones we can avoid, right? However, the more we have to avoid, the more propulsion we need. The more propulsion we need, the heavier the satellite. The heavier the satellite, the harder it is to launch, the more costly it is. Okay. The smaller debris, you can't avoid, right? There's 10 million pieces that are smaller than, you know, 10 millimeters or something the size of a BB maybe.
And moving so fast.
And they're moving so fast that a piece of debris the size of a grain of sand can actually crack your windshield. And so when shuttle returned, scientists saw the pockmarks that was created by grains of sand. They're going 14,000 miles an hour. So that's faster than a bullet. And so the impact is incredible. And if you think about it, then satellites operate with solar panels. You crack one solar panel and that will make your entire satellite defunct. There's a scientist at NASA named Kessler, and this concept called the Kessler syndrome was coined because he hypothesized that we're going to get a cascading effect because the more stuff you have there, the more it hits each other, the more stuff you get. And then the more stuff you get, the more it hits each other and so forth and so on, that at some point, there's going to be so much debris that we're not even going to be able to launch. And again, the frightening thing is, this isn't a theory that down the road we have to worry about. We are experiencing the Kessler syndrome right now. And NASA has run research and projections to show unless we start cleaning up our orbit, we're going to garbage ourselves out of being able to reach orbit.
So I want to talk about the Dish Network thing, but I'm really interested in this concept because I've been trying to make sense of it in my own head. And I think of it a little bit like the ocean, right? Which is that the ocean is increasingly polluted and the United States can't control what other countries put into the ocean, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying to clean up the ocean for our part. And so in thinking about space, you know, one country can't mandate that every other country be responsible and clean up their space activities. But what can the United States do? Maybe what are we doing to try and address this? Because we've only been up in space for a few decades, and yet we're reaching this point that you're talking about where it's going to be off limits effectively.
So the good news is after Kessler came out with his groundbreaking research or theories, NASA got very concerned and decided, okay, we are going to institute sort of mitigation guidelines. We're going to make sure you can't just send anything to space. You got to make sure that it's going to deorbit properly. You got to make sure it's not going to just fling pieces all over the place. And then they convened meetings with other space agencies and a debris council was essentially set up. And then that debris council came up with debris mitigation guidelines, which were adopted by the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space by consensus. So everybody, all the delegates in that committee, and there were probably about 70 at the time these were adopted, now they're about 100, said, yes, this is really important. We're going to follow these debris mitigation principles and we're going to incorporate them into our national laws and activities. So we do have an international push to say, look, this is a real issue. It comes up every year at the UN Committee on the Peaceful Use of Outer Space, talking about what we're going to do. And they also, in 2019, just before COVID, passed another resolution called the Long-Term Sustainability Guidelines. And they are concepts that, again, nations are encouraged to put into their national legislation that talks about mitigation and remediation. And the U.S. continues to lead in this field. As you mentioned in the opening to this podcast, the FCC, it's the first fine ever for debris in space, anywhere in the world. So we, the United States, are putting a larger burden on our licensees than any other country in the world right now. And it's not just the fine. The FCC said, okay, the international guidelines say that you have to deorbit or make sure your piece of junk is out of orbit somehow within 25 years of end of life. Okay, so just think about that for a minute. You have a piece of garbage up there, and your obligation is only to make sure it deorbits within 25 years. It's a long time for it just to sit there.
Well, it's interesting to me that you're not required to bring it back to Earth, that it's accepted that like it'll be disposed of up there. It's just a matter of where up there.
Exactly. So, and the FCC this year said, no, you know, sorry, that's not good enough. If you license with us, it has to come down within 5 years.
It has to come down.
Yep. So think about the Earth and its gravity. And so that it's a very natural concept that these pieces will come down and burn up in the atmosphere. Sometimes they're too big. If you know, we see Chinese rocket bodies coming down all the time. If you Google, you know, space junk landing on Earth, you'll see big pieces, always, you know, thank goodness, always landing in unpopulated areas. There's actually a place called Point Nemo in the middle of the ocean. And this is fascinating because it's so remote from any continent that the closest humans to it are the ones in space station. But Point Nemo is someplace the international community has said, okay, if you have something big coming down, try to make it go over there because it won't hit anybody. And this is great. And it's worked for, you know, there's Mir stuff there. There's all sorts of stuff there. But okay, we don't know what it's doing to the ocean there. Nobody's looked at what chemicals are being released from these. And we also don't know with these reentries what's happening to our atmosphere. And so right now, sort of the fix for orbital debris is bring it into the atmosphere so it burns up and then we'll move on. But again, what is that adding to the atmosphere? And so there is a wonderful company called Cislunar Industries that's like, wait, you know, no, we should be recycling it. Let's build a forge in space and don't send your satellites back down to Earth. Bring them to us and we'll, you know, melt them down and then sell that. So these are the kinds of concepts we're thinking about.
And doing that in space. So you'd have like a recycling center in orbit.
Exactly.
Wow. I'm thinking of just quantity too. You said there's 8,000 satellites. And my understanding is just Starlink, that one company, is aiming to have 40,000 satellites in space. And so we're talking about a situation that is going to become exponentially more crowded, more urgent, almost like month to month.
Absolutely. Now, again, let's also think about what these satellites look like, right? So the satellites most people think about are these big, huge things about the size of a bus, right? And they're just floating around Earth imaging. The Starlink satellites are much smaller. They're much lower in orbit than other. So they fly below the space station. And so this concept of these satellite constellations, you know, Starlink 40,000, I think Zambia wants 80,000, China's projecting 80,000, you know, that is not going to be tenable. You know, at some point we're going to have to sit back and say, wait a minute, you know, 120,000, even small satellites is not going to be workable. So this is very much a space traffic management issue. What we don't have yet, and we could think about traffic signs. Think about traffic in general, right? Mm-hmm. There's way too much traffic on the road, but the cars aren't constantly bumping into each other. What we need is sort of an international space traffic management regime so we can have sort of a right of way and make decisions about who should be going where. And again, remember that national responsibility, right? So in 2021, China sent a very formal note verbale, we call them, to the United Nations and said, Dear United Nations, it is our obligation under Article 5 of the Outer Space Treaty to warn the world if there is something in space that is going to harm humans. And they said, we are taking this opportunity now to tell you of two instances where there has been a phenomenon that has put humans in danger in space. That phenomenon was Starlink, because the Chinese said they had to maneuver Tiangong, their space station, out of the way of Starlink twice that fall. And then at the end of this very short formal, it said, and a reminder to all that Article 6 says the nation is responsible for its nationals. So United States, this is your issue. You know, basically rein your guy in. Just for the record, the U.S. responded saying, yeah, we knew and we looked at it and we didn't think it was an issue. Next time, if there's an issue, just pick up the phone and call us. You know, this is...
Yeah.
But this is what we need, is we need people to pick up the phone and call each other. It shouldn't be a diplomatic incident. This is the reality that we're facing. And we need to normalize this concept of, hey, look, you're getting a little close. You know, can we talk about it?
Yeah, it also, it just resonates with domestic politics, right? And the situation on Earth where you have a limited resource like space that is really being dominated by two countries, three, maybe four countries, but with implications for every country. And I'm just thinking of, like, for countries that aren't anywhere near having the ability to have a space program, by the time they maybe one day in the future have a space program, there's not going to be any space left. It's just going to be completely dominated by US, Chinese, maybe Russian commercial entities.
In India just, but no, this is absolutely true. So with respect to orbital slots and orbital frequency, the International Telecommunications Union actually is holding slots aside for countries that aren't spacefaring yet. And this is actually very controversial because, yes, we want to make sure that every country has the same opportunity. However, there are some very valuable orbital slots. And for example, people want to put up, you know, think about space solar power. You know, if we could use one of those those slots to actually beam energy back down to Earth, is that not a better use of this resource than holding it empty? So that's again, these are the kinds of questions we face with respect to space. And the problem is right now, we have a very small population thinking about it and worrying about it and talking about it. But it affects everybody, like you said, and we need more people involved. So that, you know, think about the space debris issue. If we don't do something, then you're not going to be able to watch the football game next weekend, right? You're not going to be able to go to your bank and withdraw money. This is something that's going to affect you directly. So you ought to be writing to your Congress people and saying, hey, spend money on cleaning up our orbit because we like the life we're living. We want to be able to use these satellites. You know, we understand that remote sensing satellites are helping us predict natural disasters, and it would be tragic if we lost that capability.
You're listening to Broken Law, brought to you by the American Constitution Society. If you're enjoying Broken Law, consider becoming a member of ACS today. You do not need to be a lawyer to be a member. As we discuss so often on this podcast, our laws and legal systems impact all of us. By supporting ACS, you support Broken Law, our work to diversify the federal bench, and our advocacy for Supreme Court reform. You also become a member of our nationwide network. Learn more about ACS by visiting our website at acslaw.org. And now, back to the conversation. I want to talk about the DISH fine specifically. We've kind of hinted at it a little bit. So this was the first one. Do you see this as the first of many? Do you think you're going to see the FCC handing these out pretty frequently now that they've established this precedent? How hard is it to hand these
hopefully
out?
Hopefully not. Hopefully people will you know, yeah, meet their license requirements.
Hopefully there's a deterrent ability now.
So this is done a couple things. First of all, it's a slap on the wrist. You know, to me,
$150,000.
And I know that it is not a slap on the wrist for a startup. You know, and $150,000 is $150,000. Yeah. But this is a slap
for
on the
DISH
wrist.
Network. It is a slap on the wrist.
If you leave your garbage up there in violation of an actual license agreement, then you should be fined. And I think in the article I said, you know, you should be banned from launching for a while. This is like a driving under the influence. If you are driving a car and you kill somebody, your license should be revoked at least for a couple years, if not forever. And so this should be the kind of fine you have. And we're not telling you have to deorbit within 2 years or as soon as your end of life. You have 5 years to do it or 25 years to do it. If you can't meet those requirements, you have no business being in orbit. So I am absolutely a stickler about that, because this is something, if you promise to do it, you do it. And your sanctions should be incredibly hard if you don't. Okay, but what has the FCC done? So it would be very dramatic for them to actually say you can't launch, and that has never been sort of in the parlance. And probably in their license it says if you fail to do this, these are the sanctions you will face. And so they got the sanctions that were in the license. It does send a signal, though. You know, $150,000 is $150,000, and you can't build that, continue to build sort of those penalties into your service fees and so forth. It also raises the question of, well, maybe now these companies should invest in debris remediation companies and companies that will, that you can pay. Maybe it was $150,000 for this fine, but it would be $50,000 if you paid a company with a little tug up there to find your junk and tug it somewhere.
Just like you pay somebody to take your trash on Earth away and to take your recycling away, you pay somebody to handle your space trash.
Exactly. And so this is an opportunity for companies to come in and say, okay, FCC fine is $150,000. I'll do it for X, and then create an economy around cleanup.
It was interesting to me that even though it was $150,000, which is, again, not a lot of money for Dish, that my understanding was it managed to erase 13% of their share price when it was first announced. And my guess is it, in part because it was unprecedented. And so it really, really stood out as a black mark against this company, at least for a couple of days.
It was interesting to me, too, because I'm curious about sort of people who use Dish Network, if it was sort of like, oh, you know, I'm not going to use them anymore because they're, you know,
they're littering in
themselves.
Space.
Yeah. I took great heart from, because people right now, the space industry is so young. And when you think about the entrepreneurs in it, the people who are involved in it, we talk all the time about making trillions of dollars in space, the gold rush with asteroids. You know what? The people in space right now, they're not looking to become billionaires. They're looking to access space and its resources in a way that will sort of benefit humanity. Nobody, I don't want to say it out loud because we want investment in space, but the people who are killing themselves to get to space, to figure out how to do this, are doing it because they love it, because they're passionate about it, because they're passionate about humanity, because they want to address climate change, because they want to find other answers to protect our future. And part of that is being responsible and sustainable. So right now, we are in this wonderful sort of nascent era of commercial space where everyone is responsible. And so seeing that drop in shares means, oh, wait, I don't want to be involved with a company that can't clean up after itself. And that, I think, is really heartening.
Are we ready, though, for, I keep thinking about what's next and the concept of like hotels in space and residential places in space. Do we have a sense of how we would, like, we obviously have housing laws on Earth, right? And you said even if you're operating in space, you're bound by the laws of Earth. I've done so many episodes where one of the issues is like there's a failure of imagination. You can't regulate that which you can't imagine happening. And so the law is so often playing catch up. And I'm wondering in space where you see that, whether we're ready and currently imagining the types of activity that could happen in space and building regulations in anticipation, or whether you see the FCC being too reactionary to activities as they happen.
It's a really delicate balance. So when you think about space, there's no imagination that can cover what might happen, right? When Sputnik overflew the world back in 1957, who knew that within 50 years, we would be so dependent on remote sensing satellites for our weather and telling us where to grow crops for surveillance and so forth? There was nobody on Earth that I think could have imagined that. So there's just no way to imagine what it might be like. The concept in space of sort of anticipatory regulation is anathema. You know, everybody who is involved in commercial space right now, when they heard you say that, was like, no, oh, oh, God, no.
Because you don't want to limit exploration, right?
Exactly.
You want to foster it and encourage people to think bigger and be even more imaginative.
Exactly. So, and I actually am sympathetic to that view. I think what we need are guidelines and principles, frameworks. Look, you know, go there, but you know, don't kill anybody while you're up there. Make sure your humans have oxygen. You know, we don't overwork your humans. Let's you know, have sort of responsibility. And right now with the nascent tourism industry, you know, there is a moratorium on regulation of human spaceflight, non-governmental human spaceflight. Right now, Congress said, okay, FAA, you will have the responsibility to regulate human spaceflight, but we don't want you to make any rules. We have a moratorium on the rules for a while because we want this industry to grow. And if you look back at the way we protected the aviation industry back in the 20s and 30s, it's the same idea. You know, the international community came together and created a regime where liability for aircraft accidents was limited. Back in the 1930s.
You didn't want to discourage
exactly
the industry. Yeah, that's really interesting. You have intentional unregulation.
Exactly. And that's where we are right now with commercial spaceflight, right? Okay. But think about it. Virgin Galactic is not going to do very well if it kills everybody on its spaceflight. So we have market forces. And, you know, a lot of questions came up with respect to the sinking of the Titan sub, you know, and that concept of informed consent. And so that is what we require of these tourists who are rich enough to go to space, is they are sat down and they are told all of the ways they can die, all of the ways they might die, all of the times, all of the ways the spacecraft can malfunction, and then they're asked to sign on the dotted line and waive their, you know, all their rights. Somebody is going to die in space. It's going to happen. And there will be a question about whether that waiver is actually valid, right? Because, you know, any good plaintiff's attorney is going to say, no, it was under duress, because if he didn't sign, he wouldn't, or she wouldn't be able to go. But that's for another day. But this is how the process is being managed right now. So when we get to hotels, it's going to be the same sort of idea. We don't know who's going to regulate that yet, right? Because the executive branch is sort of in a turmoil about where it's going to send all these new space activities for regulation. But it has to be a light hand. We can't begin to imagine what it's going to be like. And so we can have, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of let's create a basic, you know, human rights. What we have here on Earth, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, you know what that doesn't include? A right to oxygen. Because it's not something we worry about here on Earth. But I believe every human ought to have a right to oxygen in space.
Yeah, I'll be fascinated to see the drafting of that. And I feel like it is coming faster than we can imagine, maybe. But on that, again, because of the headlines, the biggest on Earth storylines right now are conflict, right? Armed conflict between nations. There's going to be armed conflict in space. There can't not be. You know, the U.S. has the U.S. Space Force. There is military activity. Does the law of armed conflict on Earth apply to armed conflict in space?
Absolutely. International law applies in space. And so, yes, the law of armed conflict, the international human rights laws all apply in space. There are a lot of complexities involved. So first of all, our foundational document, the Outer Space Treaty, does say that you cannot place nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction anywhere in space. It says the moon and all other celestial bodies must be used exclusively for peaceful purposes. Okay, so lawyers out there are going, okay, huge gaps.
Yeah.
I can put conventional weapons anywhere in space, and only celestial bodies have to be used exclusively for peaceful purposes. So I can use space for military purposes. And we have been. Our first satellites were for surveillance. So then you think, okay, we have these ASAT tests. That can't be, you know, legal. Well, the ASAT tests are perfectly legal because you're not placing a weapon in space. You're just sending something to blow something up, kinetic it. But then you get into this really interesting area because if you think about the high seas, if you have a vessel and it's flagged, the U.S. flagged vessel, that is literally sort of a little piece of U.S. sovereignty trotting across the ocean. The Article 8 of the Outer Space Treaty has that same concept. If you launch an object into space, you maintain jurisdiction and control of that object. That is your property. Okay, so if we go to LOAC and we think of Article 2 of the UN Charter, Article 51, self-defense, the right to self-defense, if your satellite is impacted, a U.S. satellite blown out of the sky, is that an attack on U.S. sovereignty that warrants a response in self-defense? And so this is really where we need to start thinking about, okay, what is going to pull us into a conflict? Because as much as we have tensions down here, space has always been something a little bit different. Partly because our astronauts say, you look back and you just see this blue marble with no boundaries. And partly because there is an understanding that if something bad happens in space, it's going to be bad for everybody. I think right now this Putin North Korea alliance concerns me because of the lack of responsible parties. Putin has shown he can be very irresponsible. But generally, the idea of a war in space, I know space is a domain of war. It has to be considered that just for defensive purposes. The United States relies on satellites more than any other country in the world, and the rest of the world knows that. And China's military strategic plan actually says, if we end up in a war with the United States, the first thing we're going to do is take down their satellites because that will cripple them. And so when we think about Space Force and what we're doing, Space Force is not Jedi Knights going out there and, circling satellites and protecting them. It's a bunch of nerds looking at radar screens, trying to figure out where everything is in space so that things can be avoided or, they just discovered this week that there was a Russian satellite tailing one of our military satellites, trying to get close to it, within 100 kilometers of it and trying to, things like that, that we have to be aware of. And so, when you think about Space Force, I really, really don't want you to think like, okay, we're going to war. No, it's just, we need to understand what's going on in that domain all the time because we rely on it more than any other country in the world. But, then you get into this sort of that Cold War strategic, build up. You have to be strong to deter. Humans are humans. Geopolitics are geopolitics. One can only hope that we get to the moon and we have two bases on the moon, an Artemis US base and a Chinese International Lunar Research Station. And that starts to build a different viewpoint. I get accused all the time of wearing my rose-tinted glasses too much, but I see peace from space. And I think we have a very difficult couple of decades to get through, but I think we can get through it.
The thing I'm taking away from this is just the importance of vigilance, of we have to think about this. We have to be paying attention. People need to be thinking about this, that there needs to be just a broader general consciousness about space than there is right now.
I was going to say vigilance and transparency, because there are a lot of things that are happening in space that could be entirely innocent, but can be read entirely differently. And so the more, good on China, they should have just called maybe, but good on China for pointing this out, that this was something they were concerned about and raising it. And so when we think, I know there was a lot of derision over the committees looking at the formerly known as UFOs, the UAPs, the unidentified aerial phenomena, I guess we call them now. But it's important to understand what we're seeing and trying to attribute it, because mistakes can be made very easily that could cause World War III. And so that transparency is a huge part of space.
Yeah. And just Starlink has had that issue where you can actually sometimes see Starlink. And so I know there are so many other aspects of this in terms of whether you have a right to an uncluttered human sky. And like, is the sky something of human heritage that should be respected? In which case, like Starlink is polluting what should be human heritage. And so it would be wonderful to have you back on and explore some of those other topics. But everything we've talked about so far is massively, massively expensive, as you have said. There is nothing cheap about space. And I think it's really easy for folks to say, we've got enough problems on Earth. Every scarce dollar we have, we really need to be focused on solving Earth's problems. We don't have time for space. And I listened to your TED Talk, which I'll link to in our show notes. You do such a wonderful job of explaining why the money we spend on space is worth it and why we need to be willing to make that investment as a government, as a people. And I would love for you to just give a shortened version of that, of why space is worth the investment.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to point out first, one of the things that the federal government is doing well now is pushing a lot of that newer stuff onto commercial actors, right? And so the taxpayer is not footing the bill for some of these, you know, for space hotels, right? When we think about what is the taxpayer getting out of space? There are so many technologies that we have that we got because we were exploring space. And it goes, it's from, you know, the foam in memory foam mattresses and maiden form bras, right? To eyeglasses, you know, getting, I'm very nearsighted. And, you know, back when I was in seventh grade, my glasses were probably, you know, like 3 inches thick. I mean, and now I can wear glasses that are very thin. There's a magazine that NASA puts out every year called Spinoff, and you can Google that. And it's probably 100, 150 pages long. And it just is all the technologies that were developed for space that have been transitioned into terrestrial uses. And it's everything from putting grooves in runways because they needed to do that for shuttle. And they were like, oh, we should do that on roads, you know, to pacemakers for hearts, all of these aspects. Okay. So those are the things we get back from space, right? And so everything we do something, it, you know, imagine if we could figure out how to grow lettuce on the moon, then we could grow anything on Earth, right?
I was going to say agriculture would just be infinitely possible here on Earth.
Exactly. But the greatest gift of space is what we don't know. When Columbus set sail for the quote unquote new world, a lot of really bad stuff happened. Absolutely. But who could have imagined back in 1492 that that would be the birth, you know, of the country that became the largest democracy in the whole world? And again, I'm not suggesting that I'm working with a lot of indigenous communities. You know, I'm very keenly aware of the horrors of colonialism, but there's no way somebody in 1492 would have seen Columbus cross the ocean and say, oh, that's just going to change the world as we know it. Not a one. And that's where we are today. We're in 1492. So far as we know where we're headed right now, there are no indigenous communities. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of wishful thinking that there will be at some point, but there's not now. And so we have this tremendous opportunity to explore, to find answers. Out there could be the cure for cancer, the cure for COVID. Out there could be, you know, we already know there's helium-3 on the moon, which if we can figure out fusion, can power the Earth for centuries. These are the answers that space affords us. And it's just, and we live in this space, right? It's like going out in your backyard to get blueberries. If you saw the blueberries there, you would go and get them. And this is where we are. We're sitting on our porch looking at a backyard, which has all of these solutions that we can't even think about. And so the idea of not setting foot in the backyard to go and get them is unethical and immoral, honestly.
It is. It does feel a little bit like a magic hat where you reach inside and you're not quite sure what you're going to find, but you're pretty sure you're going to find something.
Exactly. That's a great way of putting it. And the one thing we have to do is make sure that the decisions we're making are based on our experience of history. The one thing, you know, I am also the co-founder and CEO of an organization called For All Moonkind, which is the only organization in the world that's focused on protecting cultural heritage in outer space, protecting humanity's first footprints in space. We have a lot of history to rely on to help us do this better this time. And the one thing we really want to change is let's not exploit space. Let's not exploit the resources of space. Let's use them and let's conserve them. Let's do this thinking about generations of the future. We want them to be proud of us. We don't want to look back. We don't want our great-great-grandchildren to look back and be embarrassed by what we did. And we have the opportunity to do that for the first time ever. And I think we need to seize it.
One of the unique tenets of space that definitely doesn't apply here on Earth is that I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the tenets of it is like that you can't own space. Space is collectively owned. And so even though, you know, the US were the first folks to walk on the moon, we didn't get to plant our flag and say, this is America, right? Like, as long as we can retain that tenet where even if a private company is able to put a hotel on the moon, that doesn't mean that it's going to be an American company and the space it's on becomes American territory.
Absolutely. Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty, no state may claim sovereignty or territory anywhere in outer space, anywhere. And so this is a whole new blueprint for humanity. You know, think about the Treaty of Westphalia and just throw it out the window, because this is something new, and it's going to be very hard. There's no question. But again, we have centuries of learning and experience, and we can do this right as long as we allow ourselves to do it right.
Well, we'll end on that. And I just, one of the reasons I like listening to you is I like the kind of the philosophy that comes into thinking about space, because it is awesome. It's huge. It's so foreign and unknown, but so ripe with possibilities that it's hard to talk about and not have some sort of kind of wow moment, just because of the magnitude of something that you're talking about.
Yeah. And it goes from the very simple to just the incredibly complex and the imaginings and, you know, Star Trek and Star Wars. But I really, the concept of harnessing the assets of space and what space has to offer us just starts very simply. One very simple thing could be moving server farms off the Earth onto platforms in space. And that would be a tremendous benefit to climate change, because it's the server farms which are generating so much heat. And that's like step one, you know, thinking about that. And then all of the entrepreneurs, I wake up every morning and applaud Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Richard Branson, because thank goodness they're spending their money on space. And thank goodness for those tourists who are spending their money on those trips, because that is the way we're funding our future. And hopefully the prices will come down enough that I'll be able to take one of those orbital flights at some point.
I'm not sure I'm ready to sign on the dotted line that you referenced earlier. I do want to note, you and I noted together that neither of us had space law available to us in law school, but you obviously are teaching space law now at a law school. So this is becoming more and more available. I hope this episode encourages folks to think of this as a possibility for a career. So for folks who heard this and are more interested in learning about space law, what resources would you direct them to?
So we have an awesome booklet here at the University of Mississippi. We have put all of space law in one little booklet that's sort of a reference size. You can find that on our website and get that. But I would say, you know, more and more we're seeing space law classes pop up. So Georgetown, Harvard, University of Connecticut, Vanderbilt, Florida State University, the University in Louisiana just stood up a space law program. This is a growing field. Of course, if you are going to study space law, you have to go where it started in the United States, University of Mississippi. We've had a space law program since the 1960s with Stephen Gorove, one of the grandpapas of space law, starting that program. But I'm going to go to a quote that was made by a dear friend of mine, a space lawyer from Australia. Stephen Freeland said, look, within 10 years, if you don't know space law, you will be malpracticing your clients. That's how pervasive space is going to be in our lives. And so I encourage everybody to come on down. We offer our programs online. You can learn all about space law right from your living room.
That is amazing. And I might take you up on that. Thank you so much for joining me on Broken Law.
Thank you so much for having me. What fun.
And thank you to our listeners for finding Broken Law. If you don't already, now is a great time to follow and subscribe. And you can recommend the show to a friend. Bring us more listeners. We would love to have them. And make sure to follow us on social media at ACS Law on Twitter, at American Constitution Society on Instagram, and using hashtag Broken Law Podcast. Together, we'll speak truth to power about the law, whose interests it really serves, and whose it does not.